It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Welcome to Prognosis. I'm Laura Carlson. It's day 263 since coronavirus was declared a global pandemic. Today's main story? One of Joe Biden's first acts as president-elect was to announce a COVID-19 advisory board, putting the fight against the pandemic front and center in his presidential plans. Today, a member of that advisory board talks to us about how a Biden White House plans to overhaul the government's coronavirus response. But first, here's what happened in virus news today. The UK became the first Western country to approve a fully vetted COVID-19 vaccine. The region's regulator cleared Pfizer and BioNTech's shot this week, sooner than the US and the European Union. The emergency authorization clears the way for the deployment of a vaccine that Pfizer and its German partner have said is 95% effective in preventing illness. The shot will be available in Britain starting next week. Interpol issued a global warning to law enforcement that organized crime will target COVID-19 vaccines. The International Crime-Fighting Organization said authorities should expect an onslaught of all types of criminal activity linked to the shot. Interpol said some criminals have already begun advertising, selling, and administering fake vaccines. They added that ensuring the safety of the supply chain and identifying illicit websites offering fake products will be essential. Finally, the World Health Organization has updated its guidance on wearing masks. People should wear masks indoors and outdoors where physical distancing of at least 1 meter can't be maintained, the organization said. That's especially true in areas with community or cluster transmission. At home, people should wear a mask when receiving visitors in case of crowding or poor ventilation. The WHO recommended against wearing a mask during vigorous workouts, as well as against the use of valved masks. Face shields provide a level of eye protection only and are inferior to masks when it comes to droplet transmission and prevention.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
And now for today's main story. Tackling the surging coronavirus outbreak in the U.S. is priority number one for President-elect Joe Biden and Vice President-elect Kamala Harris. Last month, Biden named a 13-member team of doctors and scientists who will advise the new administration in responding to the pandemic. Dr. Celine Gounder, an infectious disease physician and epidemiologist, is one of those doctors. Jordan Gaspure spoke with Dr. Gounder about the makeup of this COVID-19 advisory board and how a Biden White House will approach the pandemic very differently from the Trump administration.
What is the difference between the advisory board that you sit on and the coronavirus task force team? Is there a difference between those two designations?
Yeah, so it's really interesting you ask that, because I actually had to ask for some clarification around some of this language myself. So you have the current White House Coronavirus Task Force, which is led by Vice President Mike Pence. We're all familiar with many of the members, which include Dr. Deborah Birx, Dr. Tony Fauci, Dr. Robert Redfield, Dr. Jerome Adams, and others. So that is the current administration task force. Then you have the Biden-Harris transition team, which has actually been working on these issues for months now, even before the election. I mean, you have to really develop your policy and plans well in advance so that you are ready if you are elected. And so there's a very deep bench of scientists and doctors and public health and policy experts who've been working on these issues for months. And that's the transition team. Then you have the advisory board, which was recently named, which I suppose you could say is sort of the counterpart to the task force. But I think part of the reason for calling it the advisory board is that our job really is to provide advice to the Biden-Harris transition team and to the president-elect and vice president-elect, and to function as sort of a second set of eyes on the plans that the transition team has been developing, to be thinking creatively, to be thinking big, and providing our feedback. And then also to function as something of a liaison between the transition team and the public, that could be in the form of interviews like this. And then also to help liaise, if we're asked and then there's a need, to liaise with state and local officials, including governors and public health officials, as well as with the private sector. So that could be with the vaccine companies or with the retail pharmacy chains, who are going to be really important with distribution of vaccines. So we function as sort of a layer on top of the transition team, you could say.
What role will the CDC and the World Health Organization play in this task force?
You're going to see the establishment of a new task force under the new administration, and there will no doubt be representation from the CDC, including whoever is the director of the CDC at that time. We are planning to reestablish normal relations with the World Health Organization. That's, you know, really a return to normalcy. They will not be on the task force per se. They are not now, but you will see a normalization of relationship with the World Health Organization moving forward.
What will be considered an essential service once Biden is in office in January?
I think the way to think about what is a frontline or essential worker is, first of all, what are jobs that can only be done in person? And what are services we really cannot live without? So we can't live without food. We can't live with our prescription medicines and, you know, some basic hygienic supplies. And schools really are important, not just for the education in an academic way, but also for the social and emotional supports that they provide, the social work supports that they provide. And schools are also a really important provider of food to kids. Unfortunately, many children in this country live in poverty. And so that is an essential service that schools are also providing.
I found a lot of the interviews that you've done, the things that you've said around how the task force is going to help communities that are unequipped to deal with outbreaks, very fascinating, specifically with indigenous populations and rural populations. And so wanting to pick your brain a little bit here about how the task force is planning to help those communities, in particular rural and indigenous populations.
Well, I think that has to start with how you collect your data, because you can't address disparity without knowing that there is a disparity, the nature of the disparity. You know, one common problem with indigenous populations is that they're often misclassified in terms of their race and ethnicity. This is something, as somebody who's a brown person, I have experienced myself. I'm not indigenous, but I am a I guess you could say non-specific looking brown person. And in this country, that means you generally get classified as Hispanic. My dermatologist here in New York City classified me as Hispanic, and I am not Hispanic in the medical record. And so the problem with that is if an indigenous person gets misclassified, you're not actually able to properly assess and study what the risks and outcomes and so on are in that population. So that's a really important starting point, is just getting the data right. You know, another issue that we've seen with communities of color, and this is really throughout the country, including in urban areas as well, we've seen fewer number of coronavirus testing sites in poorer communities of color than in whiter, wealthier communities, which means that it's a lot easier to get tested if you live in a white, wealthy community than in a community of color. The lines have been longer at testing facilities in communities of color. And if you're being paid by the hour on your at your job, if you're a wage worker, that means every minute, every hour that you're standing in line is also income lost. So, you know, this is something that really does need to be addressed. We need to be decentralizing as much as possible some of these services, especially to communities that are underserved, whether that's a community of color in urban areas or out to rural areas.
Will there be an opportunity for free testing once Biden gets into office?
Yeah, I think free testing, free vaccination are both very high priorities. The current administration had promised free testing and access to testing to every American who wanted testing, and that simply has not been the case, because it's not just the cost of the test, it's also the cost of everything that goes into providing somebody with a test. So that's the collection of the specimen, the swabs, the nurse time, the doctor's office visit or hospital visit. And so a lot of people got surprise bills for their coronavirus tests as a result of that. And that is something we really want to make sure does not happen, that all of those costs are covered, whether that's for a test or for a vaccination.
And Celine, my final question is around mandatory mask wearing. How will the task force implement mandatory mask wearing? And is this something that's still being discussed?
Yeah, I think there is going to be conversation with the states, with the governors around mask mandates at the state level. But I think big picture, the most important thing is to try to get people to do the right thing on their own. I think people, especially in the United States, really don't like to be told what to do. And that's the honest truth. Enforcement of a mandate is going to be a challenge. And so to really have people understand, look, masks are effective, they're cheap, they don't shut down the economy. If what you care about is keeping the economy open, this is one of the most important things you can do right now. Not to mention that it'll save many lives. This is, you know, the politicization of masks is like politicizing toilet paper. You know, this idea that based on your political party, you would or would not use toilet paper. I mean, this is a basic hygienic measure. And so we just need to reframe our thinking about it and understand that, you know, big picture, this is not a hugely burdensome thing that can have tremendous impact.
How would you get someone in these communities that are refusing to wear masks? I mean, would you need to implement a fine or some sort of punishment?
I mean, the challenge is, of course, enforcement again, and that you're going to have local law enforcement agreeing to work with you on that. I'm not sure that local law enforcement would work with you on that. So in general, I prefer the carrot versus the stick approach. I think it makes behaviors stickier and more acceptable. And I think the couple things I would suggest in terms of how to achieve behavior change, the fact is, if you look at the most recent surveys, over 90% of Americans are now wearing masks. They may not be doing it perfectly, they may not be doing it all the time, but the vast majority of Americans are doing this. And it's really small pockets of very strong resistance to this where you're not seeing that. And so I think one, to say this is becoming a social norm, I think is helpful. People tend to behave based on what is the behavior around them. I think another thing you can do is in a more personal situation, like say you're in line at the grocery checkout and somebody is not wearing a mask, I think it would be helpful for all of us to have masks on us, extra ones. And, you know, maybe you reach out to them and you say, hey, here's a, you know, you seem like a caring, kind person. Would you be willing to wear this mask to protect me? Because what you're doing there is you're framing, you're labeling them as a something positive, and then you're giving them the opportunity to live up to that and reinforce that positive label. So I think that's also, you know, depending on the situation, something else you can try. And then finally, I think we need to be reaching out to local leaders, community leaders in these pockets of resistance, and they should really be the ones leading the charge on this. And so you really need to be working in collaboration with people from the community, identifying those who might be at least somewhat sympathetic, educating them, providing them with the science, empowering them to be the leader on this issue in their community, and then let them really run with it, because they're the ones that are more likely to be trusted on this.
That was Jordan Gaspure in conversation with Dr. Celine Gounder. And that's it for our show today. For coverage of the outbreak from 120 bureaus around the world, visit Bloomberg.com/coronavirus. And if you like the show, please leave us a review and a rating on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. It's the best way to help more listeners find our global reporting. The Prognosis Daily Edition is produced by Topher Forges, Jordan Gaspure, Magnus Henriksen, and me, Laura Carlson. Today's main story was reported by Jordan Gaspure. Original music by Leo Sidran. Our editors are Rick Schein and Francesca Levy. Francesca Levy is Bloomberg's head of podcasts. Thanks for listening.
Countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.